Hello, welcome back to the National Association for Primary Education podcast. My name is Mark Taylor. I'm the Vice Chair of NAEP, and I'm also the host and creator of the Education on Fire podcast, of which NAEP has been a long-term sponsor. Now, we wanted to make sure that any fantastic conversations we were having, which were primary education focused on Education on Fire, we would release here as well to make sure that you had access to these incredibly insightful conversations, which we really hope can help you on your educational journey. So I really hope this is a great conversation that you can enjoy, which was previously released on Education on Fire. Hello, welcome back to Education on Fire. Today I'm delighted to be chatting to Eleni Adamokun, and she's from Jigsaw PSHE. Now, Eleni spent over 10 years teaching English in secondary schools, and she worked in three different state schools as well as an independent school, teaching students from years 7 to 13. Now, during that time, she was a form tutor and as part of that role taught PSHE, and after leaving the classroom, she moved into teacher education, where she delivered training and early career programmes for Teach First. She spent some time in frontline working on programmes to develop social work leaders with a strong focus on safeguarding children and young people. Now Eleni is at Jigsaw as Programs Director, where she oversees the development and design of its PSHE and RE resources, as well as providing teaching and support for schools. Hello, my name is Mark Taylor, and welcome to the Education on Fire podcast. The place for creative and inspiring learning from around the world. Listen to teachers, parents and mentors share how they are supporting children to live their best authentic life, and are proving to be a guiding light to us all. Hi, Eleni. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Education on Fire podcast. We're going to start with a topic which has been in the news a lot recently, certainly if you're listening live and we're sort of here in June 2026. But let's just start off, first of all, and talk about the Jigsaw Education Group, just in terms of your role within it and kind of sort of set the scene from there. And then we'll go from that standing point.
Yeah, of course. Thanks so much for having me, Mark. Really, really important conversation to be having. I know really prominent in a lot of people's experiences at the moment. I'm Programs Director for Jigsaw Education Group. We support schools in the UK and also internationally with personal, social, health education and also religious education as well. We are very well aware that these are absolutely key life skills subjects in schools, but quite often sidelined in terms of time, curriculum time, and also in terms of teacher expertise, training, confidence around what can often be really quite sensitive topics and quite fast moving as well, in terms of needing to be responsive to children and young people's needs. So we provide full curriculum for those subjects across 11 to 16, which includes all of the lesson plans, slides, training, and beyond. We take a real whole school approach, so we also offer outdoor learning, assemblies, songs, the list goes on and on. So that's kind of my role. And I've been at Jigsaw a couple of years, and I've been in the education sector for more than 20 years. My background originally in secondary school education for 11 years, and then also worked in teacher education and in the social care sector as well. And so really the golden thread through all of that has been about holding children and young people at the heart of all of my work in terms of their welfare, their safeguarding, and preparing them for life beyond school.
Fantastic. And I mean, that's perfect for where we are, because Education on Fire is all about having the child at the heart of everything that we do, in all of those people, the stakeholders, the people that are there to support a child within school, parents outside of school, mentors, clubs, whatever that happens to be. There are so many people trying to support children. And I think you're right that the essence of having important conversations spread across the curriculum in different ways is really important. And I love the way Jigsaw kind of comes about that and how it tries to really support schools in doing that, because it's all very well having a conversation at
2:30 on a Friday afternoon, but that's a different conversation than when it's threaded through the rest of the school week and like you say, being reactive to some of the things which come up in the media. And so our sort of focus today was that sort of Manosphere, kind of what's been in the news about that, Louis Theroux and those conversations. So why don't we start with that in terms of what it's sort of thrown up for you and also within schools and some of the solutions that which we'll get to as we go through the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think your point there around that it influences the whole of school culture, right? And so having a whole school approach, joined up approach, rather than taking a kind of really reactive immediate, like, oh, we need to do something about this, is really important to be preventative and proactive. We can come on to kind of some of that. But yeah, I mean, I think what we're seeing and hearing very much from all the schools that we work with is how much that this issue, so misogyny, the Manosphere, has infiltrated, if you like, is significantly impacting on the day-to-day experiences of teachers and young people in schools now. So what a couple of years ago would have been very much an edge, peripheral, kind of, you know, in the corners of the internet, maybe not seen that much by young people, is now their everyday exposure to some of these views purported by influencers that is then being brought into school and is impacting on school culture. So, for example, through corridor language, through teachers, female teachers feeling and seeing that they are not respected in the same way as male colleagues would be when being asked to kind of do something, for example. And also in terms of the topics of things that are coming up in PSHE, the kind of the misinformation that students are repeating from things they've maybe seen in a TikTok video, for example. And you know, this isn't just we are hearing and seeing this. I went into a school to do some training not like fairly recently, and you know, they were very much saying about how they've noticed a significant difference in boys' behavior in particular, in terms of how they're responding to female teachers. And that's supported by recent data by the NASUWT as well, which highlighted that 1 in 4 teachers have experienced misogyny in the last year as well. And then the Girl Guides have recently released data that 1 in 10 girls between the age of 11 to 16 have missed school to avoid sexual harassment as well. So it's like, you know, this is really, it's not just a fringe issue. This is in our schools. And it's also something the parents are having to support their children through as well. So yeah, it's a real... it's a real challenge. And I think the other thing to say is it's not just a secondary issue as well. I think we can tend to think that this is a challenge, you know, yeah, once they hit adolescence and teenager life kind of thing. But actually, we're hearing more and more from primary school teachers who want support and help with areas like consent, for example, who are noticing sexist language or behaviors in the playground and they want to address them. So yeah, there's definitely a need for us to be talking about this and to be thinking about how do we best support our young people, because I think the very, very important point is that this is not about blaming boys or shaming people around this. There are lots of reasons why this is happening, and we need to focus on those underlying reasons first.
And I think it's amazing, well, there are two things that strike me. One, how quickly it becomes part of the culture or part of the norm if you don't know any better, you know. And like you say, young people are susceptible, that they're sponges, they pick up everything that's around them. And with social media and, you know, the idea of the influencer and the gospel according to someone who's followed, got, you know, many thousands or millions of followers, you know, that's the world and that's the way things are. And also in terms of, like you say, people, staff and people within schools sort of feeling these sorts of things as well. I think there's something about the sense that you'd think misogyny was something which was in the past. You know, you sort of think many decades back, the society was like this and it's the way that people used to be. And, you know, rightly or wrongly, that's a different discussion. But that's kind of, it's a historic thing. And to realise how quickly this is a different version, maybe, but certainly the way the culture is adapted and it's just become, like say, part of the fabric of a conversation or a norm or a sense of this is just how it is. And until you sort of highlight, what are you thinking? What are you saying? Why are you saying it? Where did it come from? Do you understand what all this means? Then it's a really difficult thing, isn't it, to be able to sort of pick apart enough to have those proper conversations to highlight it.
Yeah. No, I completely agree with you. Like, if I think back to, you know, the early days of my career, like, this wasn't something that certainly I would say that I experienced as a female teacher or that I felt was something that was a priority as a school from a safeguarding perspective, or, you know, that we were really focusing a lot of time on or thought on. And so it really has changed significantly in a very short amount of time. And that really is because of the influence of social media, frankly, is a big one. But also the conditions that are around that too. So it isn't just purely about that, because obviously you need the other conditions, because it's about what those influences are tapping into within the zeitgeist of young people today. You know, a feeling that they are disconnected from people in general, but, you know, whether that's their peer group or feeling like there aren't role models that they can really look up to, really striving for a sense of belonging. These are all natural adolescent feelings. We've all been there. Like, we know that as the adolescent brain develops, we are naturally predisposed to break off our connections, or not fully break, but, you know, move from the family connections that we've felt so tight with as we've gone through kind of the primary ages, and naturally move away to our friendship groups. But the fact that so much of life is now online, there's this kind of surface level feeling of connection and network, but that it's not actually feeding our human needs in terms of that in-person socialization. And then that's also feeding a much lower sense of self-esteem as well that we're seeing at the moment. Between a third and a half of adolescents struggle with their self-esteem. And so when young people are trying to deal with those feelings, they're thinking about, well, where do I go? Who do I turn to? And then they see people online who are representing purportedly really positive, healthy, wealthy lifestyles, you know, the very embodiment of success, and are often like drawing young people, and especially young men, but there are also challenges for girls in this arena as well, but in with this kind of you know, lifestyle coach type mentality that's really attractive. And then very quickly it's then leading into misogynistic language or misinformation and all of that. So there are a lot of factors that I think we need to be thinking about around this.
Yeah, and it just sort of struck me, that whole sort of sense of siloed subjects as well as kind of siloed lives, because you sort of, like say, you sort of mentioned the, you know, the social media thing is quite siloed in terms of you're watching something and then there's comments, but there's no interaction in a positive way necessarily, especially if you're watching something which has got disinformation in it. But I think in schools you're often talking about all we're going to be doing maths, we're going to be doing this, we're going to be doing that. And actually, if it was a more project-based idea, I think especially in secondary school, more of those things, then the sorts of conversations you're having in working together as a group, in being critical thinking more and more and more, it sort of opens up the way of being and the way of communicating and all of those sorts of things in a very different way too. And I think that's very exciting in one respect, but also disheartening in another, because we're very set in the way secondary schools work. And I just think, like I say, across a sort of a societal conversation, maybe there are certain things that we can do which would be helping, as well as just the fact that we need to try and have a conversation today, if that sort of makes sense.
Yeah, it does. I think that, so I take your point around, you know, structure of schools and curriculum and timetabling and everything, which, you know, they can be structural challenges to changing your approach. But I also think that it can be about quality of conversation, not necessarily quantity. Mm-hmm. And I think there are opportunities for schools to really maximize those to ensure there is time carved out for real quality debate, discussion, open conversation. And I think this needs to be done in a few different ways, right? Like, so one, of course, I'm going to advocate for high quality PSHE. That is absolutely key. And that means really dedicating that curriculum time, the teacher training time to PSHE, and ensuring that it's taking a skills-based approach as well. Making sure that there is that facilitated discussion time. It's developing oracy skills as well. It's building digital and media literacy, the ability to really question what we're seeing and why. So yeah, making sure that there's that explicit teaching in the curriculum around, you know, how algorithms work, for example, because so many young people, they might have heard of algorithms and they might think they know how they work, but there is so much to unpack there that they don't always realize around the fact that it's so kind of bespoke to them. And you can quite quickly feel like, well, everyone else is seeing what I'm seeing. And so spending some time really highlighting that isn't the case. And lots else that is really important in terms of explicit teaching. But then what you're also saying is about how can we bring that in across the curriculum, make it a real whole school approach as well. So where are the opportunities in tutor times, registrations? How are staff interacting at lunch times, at break times, after school clubs? You know, what opportunities are there for young people to build relationships, strong peer-to-peer relationships and teacher-pupil relationships as well, in across all aspects of school life? And that could be through peer mentoring, or it could be through like student councils, or through like working groups on certain topics. So, I mean, there are endless things, and also through sports and, you know, other kind of extracurricular is where you can often have, you know, things might be said in jest or flippantly, but then it's a kind of less pressured environment in order to address those things. Mm-hmm. In a, you know, less intense kind of classroom base to kind of pick up and go, oh, where did you hear that? Or what makes you say that? And it's interesting. Like, even I was in a swimming pool last week when it was so hot, and a ball kind of got chucked across me as I was swimming, and I threw it back at random to the pair of children that were playing with it, and it happened to go to the girl out of the pair. And the boy just went, oh, why doesn't anyone like boys anymore? And he repeated it a couple of times. And it just struck me that, and he must have only been about 10, but like that was his first thought, you know, that there was some, it felt very, just in the way that he was saying it as well, it felt really quite, there was a real serious undertone kind of to what he was saying. And it made me quite sad. That was his, you know, I put zero thought into what I was doing at all. Yeah. But like that he had just like jumped to that kind of conclusion. And unfortunately, I think, that is where we're at the moment.
And so I guess taking that on board, there's something about the starting this young enough that like you say, that a child of 10 isn't perceiving that that's the case based on his previous knowledge or his current surroundings. And the thing that strikes me then is the fact that mirroring as well as mentoring is really important across the board, whether that's at home, whether it's in school, like say in clubs and those sorts of things. So the environment that our children are experiencing is a positive one, but also awareness being such an important thing, so that as soon as we do hear something, see something, interact with somebody, that if we're in a position where people are obviously being exposed to something in a society that we don't like, then the first thing is awareness and to do it different, but then to set the framework so that becomes eradicated. And I know that's an easy thing to say, and also it depends what part of society you're in and where your background is and what your support network happens to be, because it might be that you can put all these things in place, but there are certain areas, certain families, certain groups of people that will be drawn into these things for whatever reason that happens to be. And so understanding we do the best we can for everybody, and I guess then you pinpoint the flashpoints, the targeted people where you know they might need a little bit more enlightening awareness in order to change those sort of beliefs.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. There needs to be a combination of taking a universal approach and a preventative one, in which there's a really clear framework and curriculum to support all children. And as you say, from really early on, and that doesn't mean that we're teaching about misogyny to 5-year-olds at all. This is about ensuring that there's clear content and learning development around socialization, around relationships, healthy relationships, self-identity, self-esteem, belonging, like all of these key underlying principles that are preventative practices for like when a child, a young person then comes across any of this later, that, you know, we want to prepare them to question what they see and what they hear more, be more critical and discerning in terms of their media and digital literacy, but also confident in like what's right, what's wrong, what feels right to me, what feels wrong to me in terms of those, role models, and relationships more broadly. I think that's really important. But then the other point you made was around that more interventionist type of approach as well, which again is really important, because this can essentially come down, it's a safeguarding issue and should be treated as such. If a child or a young person is sharing misogynistic views or is that's coming out in their behavior or their approach to their peers and everything, we need to treat that in the way that we would treat any other kind of behavior like that, and therefore have one-to-one conversations with them, put a mentor in place for them perhaps, really make sure that we are as well engaging with that young person. So this it cannot be about punishing them or sanctioning, because ultimately what happens then, they feel shamed, and we're just reinforcing the messages that they're hearing from influencers.
Yeah.
Right. So you're more likely to push them back towards those influencers and to push them even deeper into down that hole, if you like. And so we really need to be making sure that we're having those open conversations, that we are really listening to what they're saying, and then using where we can facts to challenge back around the kind of misinformation they might be sharing. But yeah, you're right. So there's this balance between this universal and a more personalized approach that is definitely needed.
Yeah. And something that really struck me, we've recently done a podcast series with Professor Dr. Gare Grouse, and one of his big quotes is all about children can only aspire to what they know exists. And what just struck me that as we've been chatting is the fact that children only generally know what they know exists. And the thing about social media and the thing about technology generally and the algorithm side of these things is the fact that you get a very warped picture of reality, because you get fed the things you start to look at, the things you start to hear, the things you start to click on, all of those sorts of things. So Talk to me a little bit about the kind of that bigger picture, being able to say to people, I know you're seeing all of this, or this is something you're exposed to, but the reality in a whole is going to look different. You know, the reality of these stats, the numbers of people who are actually talking in this way, thinking in this way, because I think it's very hard for children or anybody these days to get a real understanding of what the whole picture is, because it's all so skewed depending on the tech a lot of the time and what it's actually feeding you, because you get fed, like I said, what you're involved in.
Exactly that. And that is one of the biggest challenges as a teacher and also as a parent. I'm a parent to two girls, and what is coming up on like their feed versus my feed is totally different. So how that is genuine, like how do we have these conversations like proactively and preventatively, when actually young people are often like a step ahead of us, you know? No, and they, you know, all of this is catching us off guard, and all of this is, you know, and that's what schools are telling us about, is like they're having to respond to this on a day-to-day basis and not necessarily feeling prepared and upskilled for it. There's no kind of getting around that, right? So I think we have to just own that. And I think even but having those conversations with young people about, like, you know, kind of, I'm not sure that I would be advocating for teachers to share their social media, but in terms of giving an example of the kind of things that might be coming up on their stream, you know, versus the kind of things that would be coming up on theirs. But again, this is why it is the framework that underpins our interactions is the most important thing, rather than the detail of exactly what they're seeing, right? So it's about feeling empowered about how do I approach those conversations when they come up, because teachers are very much on the front line of this, and are probably going to be the first to hear about things in a school environment before parents do, as well, because that's often feels like a safer space, right, for children to share their experiences, and they're often a shared experience as well, which is not the case with parents. And I know this myself, like as a parent. I was reading an article the other day in the Metro, and it was talking about this is the language you should be aware of, you know, that's being used. So something like sub five, for example, like you should be aware of and other things. And so that made me think, I want to have a conversation with my 14-year-old about, like, has she been hearing or seeing this kind of language? She hadn't heard sub five. She had heard of looks maxing, but she didn't really know what it was. But it just meant that we could kind of, I was just intrigued. Is this content that she is exposed to or not? And what's her understanding of it? I just think it's about keeping that conversation going as much as possible, really, both at home and in school.
Yeah, and I think, like I say, it's very easy to get negative on these things, but also, like you said there, it can be supportive as well when you're having these conversations, because you're assuming they're being exposed to all the things you hope they're not being exposed to. And then you realise, oh, actually, no, they're not. And also, the fact that certainly from my point of view as a parent, was the fact that the things that we were concerned about when we brought these things up in conversation as a family was the fact that, no, we know this, we get this, we understand what this is all about. And they were much more clued up and much more kind of, I wouldn't do that, we don't touch that, we're aware of that, and that's not part of how we work as a friendship group in our social media interactions and all those sorts of things. And then that sort of gave us sort of a real support of kind of, they are aware, but they're doing the right thing, in inverted commas, or supporting themselves, but also knew that we were prepared to talk about these things. And if there was an issue, and occasionally something comes up and it blindsides you one way or the other, you're able to go, okay, we know, and we've had enough of these conversations to know, right, okay, we can deal with this, or we can sort of have a proper discussion about it being something too overblown, as it were, because it might just be, like you say, a reframing or a chance just to have a safe space to see where you go with these things. And so that could be a really positive thing, like I say, as opposed to it being a negative.
Absolutely. And I think there's a real there's a real challenge and a tension in PSHE education around how much, what approach to take when teaching any topic, right? Especially at secondary level, where there are some within the new in England, we've got relationship, sex and health education statutory guidance that we have to, that schools have to comply with and meet. You know, there's some quite hard hitting topics within that guidance. And so for example, pornography, the statistics, you know, are pretty damning, if you like, in terms of exposure to pornography from like age 11. But that doesn't mean that everybody in a classroom has been or has different levels of exposure. So it's about how can you, it takes your expertise to think about how do you teach that in a way that doesn't overexpose or assume a certain level of knowledge, whilst also delivering the protective kind of education that all children will need, when, you know, so they have it when they need it, but also for those that maybe have been exposed, to ensure that we're not shaming them or making them feel like they've done something like wrong. So there's real complexities there. And I think the other point is, you know, it's great that you've had that similar experience to me in terms of having these open conversations. There's a lot of research out there that there are a lot of children that don't feel like they have that trusted adult, even one trusted adult in their lives. And that's coming through in a lot of the research in the UK at the moment around young people that aren't in education, employment or training. We call them NEETs. And that a lot of the factors there are around that, like feeling like they haven't got that person that can give them the tough love, or that they can have these that are there behind them, you know, their safety net. I think this, you know, we're very lucky and privileged that we've got those relationships. It's not the case for all young people. We want it to be. Everyone should have one trusted adult, at least to turn to.
For sure. And like I'm saying, that's a really important, I think, place for schools as well, because hopefully the setup is such and the skill set and the knowledge and those sorts of things. And I think one thing I just want to sort of round up with here is what you mentioned, which I think is so important, is the framework. Because the reality, of course, is that we can be talking about misogyny today, but we know that maybe next week something else is kind of in the middle of the media storm, and then next year is going to be something else, and the year after is something else. And so while all the subjects are really important at the time, knowing that the subjects will change, but what children need is probably the same, just with a different focal length, a sense of what it is that we need to talk about in a different way. So as long as the framework's there and the skill sets are there and the awareness is there, we can hopefully guide and morph in a way that's going to be as supportive as possible.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely key. And that's where like a skills-based approach is really important. Alongside the knowledge, there is clearly, you know, an important knowledge base within PSHE and all of this education. But it really does need to be underpinned by strong skills based around how to build and maintain healthy relationships, for example, how to keep yourself safe. You know, those principles are true in physical as well as online. All of these things, then we're preparing them for whatever comes at them. And then we can change the kind of, like you're saying, the scenarios that are most relevant, or we, you know, adapt that. And having a responsive curriculum is important to continue to meet the needs of children. But the foundational principles and making sure there's really dedicated time and expertise to that is absolutely key.
And I think that's where these conversations I think are so important, and I really love the chance to be able to have them, because I feel stronger now maybe than I did half an hour ago, because like you say, the knowledge, the understanding, the being able to talk around it with all the different implications suddenly gives you a sense of, okay, this isn't coming completely left field and we don't know what to do about it. We just need to have that focus, that awareness, and step into what, you know, teachers are trained to do and what parents are trying to do best for their children and all of those things. And I think that feels very positive, and it means we need to work harder for those that are more vulnerable, but hopefully more supportive for those children that have the support that they need already.
Absolutely.
Now, the acronym FAR is really important to us here on the podcast, obviously. And by that, we mean feedback, inspiration, resilience, and empowerment is part of our FAR. What strikes you when you see that, or any particular word that kind of jumps out at you?
Yeah, I mean, two from what we've been talking about, like resilience, definitely. So what we're talking about here is how do we build young people's resilience against whatever challenges that they are going to face. And at the moment, one of them is around misogyny and the manosphere. So how do we do that? How do we really build the resilience of teachers and all adults that are in a young person's life so we can be what they need to launch them into adulthood at 18 with the real skills to thrive in life. And then I think empowerment as well, because that's really what we exist to do, is to empower young people and teachers through education to thrive in life.
I love it. Eleni, thank you so much. This has been so important and so helpful and supportive, I think, for everybody. Jigsaw is something and an organisation which I think helps people in so many different ways. So make sure people know where they can go and find out those specific resources and support they can get.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can find out more about us at jigsaweducationgroup.com. And you can get a sample of our materials there, or we can book a meeting to talk you through what we can offer for schools. And if you're also on LinkedIn, so follow me on LinkedIn too.
Amazing. Keep talking. Everybody listening, everybody watching, I think that's the start, the middle and the end. And I think from there, we can Absolutely. Sort of help guide each other through everything that comes up. So yeah, Eleni, thank you so much indeed.
Thanks so much, Mark.
Many thanks for listening, and you can find out the latest things that are going on within NAEP by going to naep.org.uk. There's links to the latest events, their YouTube channel, details about their journal Primary First, and much more. That's naep.org.uk.